Hey, Sound Opinions listeners, if you support us on Patreon, you get to listen to our podcast ad-free on Patreon.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week it's time for a classic album dissection of Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. We'll talk with a musician who played on the record and some music writers about what makes the record so iconic. Let's get to it. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island since 1988. Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find 312 Wheat Ale, Big Juicy Beer Hug, and so many other limited releases at either of Goose's locations in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Greg, I think we have to start with a little bit of the context of the times. You know, the turbulence of the late 60s, everybody seems to think that it stopped in 1968, the pinnacle, those assassinations, the riots. In fact, like a bad hangover or a nightmare that you can't wake up from, really the mid-70s, into the mid-70s, was a very dark time. I went back and looked at 1974. We have Nixon finally resigning, you know, Watergate, the denouement, and Gerald Ford coming in and pardoning him. And, you know, bombings. There was a great book I read a few years ago, Days of Rage, America's Radical Underground, by Brian Burrow, that, you know, what you often think about anti-war protesters bombing FBI offices, that sort of thing, that it reached a pinnacle in the 60s. No. It was the mid-70s where we saw this, not only in the U.S., groups like the FALN and left-wing radical groups, but around the world, several key tragic IRA bombings in the Troubles over in the UK, you know, a fascist group in hitting a train between Italy and West Germany, bombings by the left in Japan. It's a violent time where people just can't seem to talk to one another. And and you can hear it in some of my favorite albums released that year, the same year or just before Dylan would release Blood on the Tracks. Neil Young is in the same place as Dylan with On the Beach, right? Robert Wyatt of The Soft Machine releases Rock Bottom, which is a title that really stands for the times. He's you know, finding catharsis in being paralyzed. Richard and Linda Thompson are still married, but I Want to See the Bright Lights Tonight is fraught with tension. And Van Morrison is in a dark place, too, with Veden Fleece, emotional turmoil in that record. And then elsewhere, you see music really straying far from what Dylan had been doing and planting the seeds of everything that'll come, making Dylan, like, you know, the question which has been asked for his entire six-decade career, is he still relevant? You know, you have Kraftwerk's Autobahn coming out and saying, hey, there's a new synth sound to coming. You know, Joni Mitchell is swerving into jazz with Court and Spark. Barry White can't get enough, right? Disco is on the horizon. You know, what does Bob Dylan have to say anymore? And where is he in his life?
Yeah, 74 was a big year because Dylan had basically been out of the public eye for like 7 years. You know, he had that motorcycle accident when he'd moved to Woodstock in July of 66. He was newly married to Sarah Lowndes. They had four children. And Dylan basically went off the road after the motorcycle accident. He just kind of holed up and was a dad, and apparently a very good father from the reports that we got. He was very attentive and a husband at that time. So he was releasing records with increasingly less acclaim. People were wondering, what is Bob up to? We're not quite getting this newer music that he's doing. It was a far cry from the peak period that he had.
Have the times passed him by?
Exactly. So things start to shift. In November 73, already had done recording sessions with the band, reunited. Mm. When they last played together, the band was known as the Hawks, and that apocalypse tour of the UK when they were getting booed on stage
for
every night
electric,
for being
yeah.
electric as opposed to folkies. Now they were coming back as sort of the, you know, oh my God, this has come back to us, and we are greeting them with open arms and open wallets. 40-day tour in the beginning of 1974 that sold out sports arenas. It was kind of groundbreaking at the time. Mm. These guys are playing hockey arenas and filling them with people, right? So the band is back together with Dylan, and Planet Waves goes to number one, and suddenly Dylan's back in the spotlight, right? But meanwhile, his marriage is starting to fall apart. You know, the fact that he went back on the road, he and Sarah had purchased a home in California in 1973, and, you know, I think a lot of people can relate to the fact that once you do like a home rehab, you start building out your house, you're going to argue with your wife, and your wife's going to argue with you, you
even
know?
Even if you're Bob Dylan?
Yeah, even if you're Bob Dylan. And apparently things just escalated. They started arguing for the first time in their marriage, where they were really kind of at odds with each other. Bob started drinking, smoking again, you know, and heading out. Eventually they split up. They broke up in 1974.
Now,
they
Bob,
were not
of course,
yet divorced.
Bob, of course, denies that Blood on the Tracks is about the relationship with Sarah unraveling. Jacob, his son, to whom, as you said, he was very attentive in the early years, says, that's my parents talking about each other. That's what that album is. You know, but Bob always, you know, whenever we think we have him nailed, he'll say the opposite.
Well, he's given, like, different versions of that record for years.
Yeah.
But the point was that he wrote a bunch of songs immediately after he and Sarah had sort of split up. Sarah stayed in the house in California, and Bob moved apparently to Minnesota for a while, back where he, you know, the state where he was born.
Back to his roots.
And he calls up John Hammond, his mentor at Columbia Records, and said, I've written a lot of private songs, and I want to record these songs in the fall of 74. So suddenly we've got a new Dylan album in the works. This time he's not going to record it with the band, as he had with Planet Waves. He goes back to the scene of his greatest moments. He goes back to Studio A at A&R Studios in New York, where he had recorded some of his best records in the 60s. Phil Ramone comes in as the producer. Phil now owns that studio. And Ramone assembles this band, led by Eric Weisberg, the great banjo and guitar player, and his Deliverance band, these top session players. So they're working this session in New York in the fall of 74, 5 days. Dylan's kind of a remote figure in the studio. These songs are like freaking everybody out.
Yeah.
They're very private, very, the tone of the music is very dark.
Well, and one of them that you're going to talk about yourself is probably the nastiest song he's ever written.
Right, right. And the band just never really connected with him because he was in his own space in that studio. And the record is set for release before Christmas of that year. They wanted to put, Columbia wanted to put it out in 74. The liner notes had been written. The packages is all ready. And then Dylan goes back to Minnesota, plays it for his brother. And his brother's going, Bob, I don't know if this is cutting it. And Bob listens.
That's really fascinating to me. You know, all the Dylan books I've read, that relationship with his brother is not really probed enough. And I think it's great that at this stage in his career, this icon, you know, he still has people in his life who he'll listen to. Because that so often doesn't happen. The superstar becomes, you know, tunes out all negative criticism.
Very, very true. And I think Bob was starting to have doubts, too, because he listened to the record again. And he goes, I don't know. And he played it for his brother. And his brother sort of confirmed some of those feelings. There's now people who say that original version of the record is the record. It should have been the one they put out. People like Robbie Robertson, his compadre in the band, Joni Mitchell, who'd heard it, you know, said, why didn't he put this out? But Bob was going in a different place, and you know, suddenly these local guys that we're going to be talking to here in a minute did, in fact, play on this record, didn't get credit for it because they never were able to change the sleeve liner notes when the record came out.
It's one of the great stories in rock history.
It truly is.
I mean, because he's back in, you would have thought Columbia could make hay of that. Bob Dylan returns to the folk scene of Minnesota, where he came from, and plays with these guys who all have a rep in Minneapolis, right. St. Paul, you know. And they were real players. They were roots players. Mm-hmm. They loved this music. That's where he came from.
So in 2 days, he has an incredibly successful run with this group mm-hmm. of guys. 2 days, they record 5 songs, and Bob's pleased.
Yeah.
He said, these 5 songs are going to replace the ones that are already on the album. These versions are better, in his viewpoint, fit the album better than the originals. So we're going to talk about that a little bit as well.
Before we get to the interviews, Greg, we're each going to play a song that we think really resonates with us and epitomizes the album. We talk a lot in the interviews about Tangled Up in Blue, so we chose other songs. And I had to go with Shelter from the Storm, the second to last track on the record. The Dylanologists say that he's grabbing things from Yeats here. It starts with some Christian symbolism up top. It is trying to find in love an escape from all the crap in the world. Like I said, 68, everybody thinks, no. 74 is a dark time in America, in the world, for Dylan, and it's resonating with him. And he's looking for shelter from the storm. And he's hoping to find it in a new relationship. And he doesn't, because the way the song turns around, there's amazing cynicism. I mean, look at the way it starts. Here's the Christian symbolism. 'Twas in another lifetime, one of toil and blood, when blackness was a virtue, the road was full of mud. I came in from the wilderness, a creature void of form. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. And it's like, wow, we all want a relationship like that. But by the end, he's getting nasty, and you're gonna need, like I said, you're gonna talk about him being even nastier. Beauty walks a razor's edge. Someday I'll make it mine. If I could only turn back the clock to when God and her were born. Wow. Now he's wishing her like that she never existed. Mm. So much for shelter from the storm. There is no shelter for Bob at this dark point.
Well, I'm living in a foreign country, but I'm bound to cross the line. Beauty walks a razor's edge. Someday I'll make it mine. If I could only turn back the clock to when God and her were born. Come in, she said, I'll give ya shelter from the storm.
Shelter from the Storm, my standout track from Blood on the Tracks by Dylan. But only because you won the wrestling match. We had an arm wrestling match, and you got the next one.
Well, I really think Idiot Wind is the key to the record, mm-hmm. and it's interesting that he chose to re-record this one. The original version is pretty dark, and it's pretty low-key. It's Dylan. I think it's the darkest place he's ever gone to in many ways, saying a lot.
Yeah.
And it's also one of the most bilious tracks he's ever recorded. I mean, it's savage. It's absolutely a savage put down of someone very close to him who he feels betrayed by. Hence the connection to his soon to be former wife. You can see why people make the connection. Dylan has always danced around the idea that he was writing directly about Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard to escape the idea that he is, in fact, hurt in this song. And he's attacking this person.
Lashing out.
This is in the tradition of like a Rolling Stone or Ballad of a Thin Man or Positively 4th Street, those kind of songs where you're going, whoa, he's really mad at someone here, right?
Well, and there he tends to be madder at, what he called in another song, the masters of war, the powers that be, the forces that would stamp out individualism. Here he's mad at a person. I wouldn't want to be on the other end of that.
And the version that he chose is more up-tempo, the one he recorded with the Minnesota musicians is more up-tempo. It's also more savage. The phrasing is very pointedly, hostile. I mean, it's cruel. It's a cruel song.
It's a cruel song.
You know, you're an idiot, babe, you know. It's a wonder that you still know how to breathe, you know. These kind of lines. I saw him do a version of this song, which I believe now, having listened again to the original version of the song that was recorded in New York, was closer to that tone, where you get a different feel for the song. The song in New York is very rueful, almost like regret-filled. It's melancholy. And I think the key to the song is in the last verse, instead of you pointing the finger at you, he starts singing about we. We're idiots, babe. It's a wonder we can even feed ourselves. Let's hear a little bit of Idiot Wind from the New York session, the one that he chose to replace later on.
We pushed each other a little too far, and one day it just turned into a raging storm. A hound dog bayed beyond your trees as I was packing up my uniform.
He's changed the lines in these songs over the years.
Many times.
There's at least three different versions of this song around that period where he changed the lyrics many times. And the song's meaning changes because of that. And I think that's why it's a classic Dylan song.
It absolutely is.
Now here's a little bit of Idiot Wind from the Minnesota session, the one that actually ended up on the Blood on the Tracks album. And you can hear the difference in tone.
I've been double-crossed now. Separated you from me.
Idiot Wind by Bob Dylan from Blood on the Tracks. We are in the midst of a classic album dissection of Dylan's 15th studio album. When we come back, we'll re-air our interview with musician Kevin Odegaard, where he talked about being called in at the 11th hour to help out Bob Dylan on Sound Opinions. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island Beer Company. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in and inspired by Chicago. They got 312 Wheat Ale, Hazy Beer Hug, and many more one-off beers at the Fulton Street Tap Room or their new Salt Shed Pub. The perfect place to go before a show at the Salt Shed. Me and Andrew were there on opening night, Greg. Mm-hmm. It was really exciting. You had Rocky Mountain spotted fever, tick fever. I'm sorry about that. Anyway, every time we go to one of these goose joints, there's another new one to try, and we love them all.
I'm a fan. In addition to making great products and event spaces, Goose Island has always been a supporter of music culture in Chicago and nationwide. I mean, if you see that Goose Island logo at a venue or a restaurant, you know you're in good hands.
Yeah, we are proud to be associated with Goose Island. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer, and Sound Opinions is. Sound Opinions is brought to you by NordVPN. NordVPN is the gateway to secure and private access to the internet. We all need that. And it works by enveloping all of your online activities in a layer of encryption while also hiding information about your virtual location. Greg, before I had a VPN, I was sitting in a doctor's waiting room, and boy, did I get hammered with a virus. I mean, I'd go to the doctor and get rid of a virus.
Well, safety from viruses is one of the great uses of NordVPN. It's an incredible tool. It's easy to use. You can connect with just one click and enjoy the amazing speed on every major platform, from Windows to iOS to Android. Now, this summer, I'll be doing some traveling.
You're going overseas.
This is a necessity. You know, you've got to use this. I know I can count on NordVPN to help me easily access secure connections on public Wi-Fi in airports, hotels, cafes, anywhere I go. You know, it's easy to get hacked these days, right?
Yep.
This will help. It also makes it easy to access paid subscriptions to streaming services and content, even if it's not available in the country I'm in.
So you can watch your Netflix while you're sunning it in Europe.
Absolutely.
If you want safe access to your favorite streams, social media, and more, no matter where you are, get an exclusive NordVPN deal here at nordvpn.com/soundopinions. nordvpn.com/soundopinions. It's risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee, and the link's in the description of this episode.
And we are back. This week, we're doing a classic album dissection of Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks. Next, we revisit an interview we did way back in 2001 with Kevin Odegaard. Kevin was pulled in to the emergency Minnesota recording sessions for the album when Dylan decided at the 11th hour to remake much of it. He was a guitarist, and he ended up contributing much more.
Kevin, you and I have talked about this before, but this is a pretty undocumented still that you and your friends in Minneapolis played on this record. Still sort of a lost piece of rock history. I'm pretty familiar with all the rock bios, and it gets mentioned in passing, and still some of the facts get wrong. Tell us the story of how you came to work on Blood on the Tracks in that winter of 75.
Got a phone call. I was a railroad brakeman. I thought it was the crew caller. Didn't want to go to work. It was 10 below outside. It was freezing, so I ignored it. And it just kept ringing and ringing, and finally picked it up, and it was David Zimmerman looking for a guitar, a very particular guitar.
David Zimmerman being Bob's brother.
Right, who I had been friends with for some time, and he had been managing my career. It was a 1937 0042 Martin, and that's exactly what he asked for. I don't know why. I think it was known in circles, or became known in music circles later, as the Joan Baez guitar. It's a small body guitar that had a particularly good sound in a recording studio because it didn't overpower the microphones during the 1970s. So I knew David was up to something. I knew Bob was in town before the phone call was over, because David didn't play guitar. And I just put two and two together and figured, well, Bob's in and he needs a guitar. I had no idea at the time the opportunity that was about to present itself.
And so what happened? Did you end up going to a session with this guitar?
Well, I called up my pal Chris Weber, who owned the Podium Music Shop in Dinkytown, one of Dylan's old hangouts. And Chris was pretty astounded. And as a matter of fact, I just heard the exact story about 5 minutes ago. A guy had walked in from a local suburb just a few days earlier with the exact guitar Dylan was looking for in a case, almost untouched. And Chris said, well, yeah, I happen to have that guitar. I think there were three or four phone calls exchanged from that point forward, and Chris, being a music shop owner, was used to flaky musicians like myself calling him and trying to con him out of, you know, very valuable instruments. I don't know how many are in the world today. I actually have Chris as a resource in the room. How many are there, Chris? 20 or 40? Probably 20 in the world of this kind of guitar.
Wow.
And he had one of them. So I struck gold on my first phone call. It was just serendipity. I don't know what happened. But I called David back, and he said, oh, well, that's good, because Bobby's in town, and he's not real happy with the stuff that he did in New York. And I said, well, what's that? He said, well, he's just finished an album, and we've got the jackets printed, and he's just not happy with it. He feels it needs more punch, and wondered if you could help us line up some musicians. So right away, I put myself on top of the list, and
you nominated yourself to play.
Justifiably, you're finding one of 40 guitars in the world for the guy. That's fair.
Our conversation was short and sweet. It nearly swept me off of my feet, and I'm back in the rain.
I said, well, what are we looking for? And we talked about it for a while. David tracked down Billy Peterson, Bill Berg, who were the very finest jazz bass and drummer, the very finest in the Twin Cities, possibly one of the best in the country, at a group called Natural Life. He chose them, and I came up with Greg Inhofer. And then I called back Chris Weber to try and seal the deal on this guitar and get this guitar down to the sessions, because one of the things that David Zimmerman had asked me to do was shut the heck up. Don't tell anybody about this. Wanted to preserve the secrecy of the session.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't want a lot of extra people around bothering Bob. So we went back and forth. Chris negotiated himself onto the session.
Sounds like this sounds like remarkably like the Al Kooper story from 1965.
But
Al
fair.
Cooper just happened
that's
to
fair.
Sit in that. Yeah, that's cool.
Where Cooper's did you go? No organ player. He can't play that
yeah,
organ.
Right.
Now I've lived in Minneapolis twice, Kevin. Where did you guys record?
Sound 80.
Mm-hmm.
It was Herb Pilhofer's state of the art studio. It was really the only place David would have chosen because the house musicians were Peterson and Berg.
Mm-hmm.
And another funny story. There's a funny story with every sentence of this story because Peterson shows up and thinks he's at another ad gig.
Mm-hmm.
And he sits down and he looks up and there's Bob Dylan. And he says, hey man, what's going on?
Yeah. Well, you know, this incredibly weird combination with Dylan of generosity toward musicians, the willingness to let Cooper try to play an organ part he never played, the willingness to let you guys come in, you know, having the jazz guys play on his record, on this record, in a fairly rock vein, you know, stuff like that. And then also this weird stinginess, this weird, you know, he's had this great touring band for the last couple of years, but he isn't making records with them. And then you guys do these classic versions of these songs, but you don't get credited for them. I mean, that's got to rankle a little bit. And where do those two sides of this guy come from?
I polled everybody when I did an article recently on how rankled everybody was, and there were some mild feelings about that. They've passed. It's been 26 years. We've all had a chance to realize that this is basically something we're going to be able to share with our grandchildren. But then, just very, very recently, I was asked to do this recollection for Minneapolis St. Paul magazine, and Greg, I was encouraged by you to do this, and you helped me with some of the early drafts because it's really a piece of history that's been misreported, misconstrued. People have been left out. Even the new Howard Sounds book, as good as it is, leaves out two of the musicians. Well, leaves out all of the musicians.
Mm,
it's
yep.
just Peterson and Berg in there. And they were truly the geniuses in the session, in my view. Berg and Dylan were the two bright, shining stars in the session. The rest of us were there, and we were. I think we came in the right places, and certainly everybody played their parts well. But I saw Berg as really, really brilliant on the drums.
Mm-hmm. But you guys have sort of you guys seem pretty cool with the idea that you know, you were able to play on the session, and there's not a real, you know, lingering bitterness here, that you've sort of been written out of a lot of the histories. One of the great records of all time, and you really haven't gotten the credit that you deserve for playing on it.
Well, no, we're not cool about it. We're begging RIAA, and we're begging Columbia Records, and we're writing letters to the Dylan office in New York, Jeff Rosen there, and we were told at the sessions. And I've got two of the guys in the room with me right now, so they'll shut me up if I don't tell the truth here. But we were told at the sessions that, hey guys, this is the cover. It's been printed. You're not going to be on the first printing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So we all kind of naturally hoped and prayed that we'd be on the second pressing.
Yeah, right.
26 years later, you're still buying.
And how many pressings?
Blood on the tracks.
Blood on the tracks.
With,
yeah.
With these New York
God
imposters.
God knows how many. The other thing about the credits is when we finally did get credits, and I just discovered this recently, it was on Bob Dylan's Greatest Hits Volume 3.
Hmm.
And I'm Ken Odegaard. Billy is Billy Preston, who is, you know, completely a Beatles guy.
A different person.
Instead of Peterson. And
that's amazing. That's
and
just
Chris
shoddy.
Weber's name is perennially spelled with the wrong number of B's in it. It has one B in it. So we were all very, very, very grateful to get the recognition, and I'm sure it was somebody at Columbia Records who said, well, let's actually list the musicians on this. Somebody
just would have been nice if they spelled your names right.
That's disastrous. But, Kevin, we got to talk about this music. You'd pointed out at the very start of this conversation that David Zimmerman had indicated to you that Bob was dissatisfied with what had happened in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, something happened in the studio in Minneapolis with you guys that changed this stuff. You obviously weren't playing the songs the exact same way they played them in New York. Something happened.
We had a great conversation about this tonight mm-hmm. with everybody in the room that was there.
What happened with Tangled Up in Blue?
Right. With Tangled Up in Blue, exactly, what happened was it was tame. It was laying there. It was doing nothing. He went through it, and I just, serendipity again, I just happened to be sitting next to him in the room, and he quietly turned to me and he said, "Well, what do you think of that?" And I said, "Well, it's passable." And he looked at me, and he gave me that look that he gave Donovan in the documentary, "Don't Look Back." And he looked at me again, and he, "Passable? What do you mean passable? That doesn't sound too good. Passable? What's passable? What do you mean passable?"
Early one morning, the sun was shining. He was lying in bed, wondering if she changed it all of her hair was still red.
You know, and he went into his thing.
Yeah.
And I thought for sure,
that was the end of your session.
I was going to be roasted, and it was all over for me. And all the other musicians were, you know, kind of waiting for the outcome of this one. And I was sweating right through my clothes. Finally, he looked up and said, "Okay, well, you know, what do we got to lose? Let's give it a shot." He got about halfway through a verse, and it kicked ass.
Early one morning, the sun was shining. I was laying in bed, wondering if she changed it all, if her hair was still red. Her folks, they said our lives together sure was gonna be rough. They never did like Mama's homemade dress. Papa's bankbook wasn't big enough. And I was standing on the side of the road, rain falling on my shoes, heading out for the East Coast. Lord knows I paid some dues getting through.
So he said stop to Paul Martinson in the booth and went right into it, reaching for the notes. Much more urgency,
mm-hmm.
much more energy in the song. One take, that's it. It was never remixed. That two track rough from the session is on the record,
mm-hmm.
and that was it.
Mm-hmm. So knocked
one up. Of the most gorgeous. I've got the harmonica player that's working with us. We were just talking about that brilliant solo, and Dylan is no virtuoso, but that solo at the tail end of "Tangled Up in Blue" is like a, you know, a musical Picasso. It's really very special.
Well, Kevin, you know, as a Minneapolis guy, I mean, there's always this thing that I call the Prince syndrome, where an artist gets to a certain point where he has gotten rid of all the people who came up with him, you know, all the people who were his managers, his friends, his bandmates, and he's surrounded by this new crew of people once he's become successful, and he no longer has the fortitude to have people say, "No, that's a bad idea," to be challenged. And one of the things I think is encouraging about Dylan is he's always putting himself in situations where people will say to him, "Hey, Bob, that's not so good. Try it this way." In his band says, I just think it's interesting that then he doesn't credit them.
yeah. That's
well, I don't know that many people challenge him. I've always, you know, I've read all the books. And
well, I think the current band is kicking his butt for the last 5, 6, 7 years.
I sure hope so. I hope you're right about that because, you know, I've been around him a number of times before and since, and the man is surrounded by yes men, and he's made some records that you can tell. Or was at certain points, but I was no genius for speaking up. I just told them what I thought. You know, it was just the way I felt about it. I didn't really have much to lose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of the key and the serendipity of that whole session. Just being able to go in there with a group of guys he'd never met before, go in there and record one take of a song.
Yeah.
It ends up being a classic that's played on radio for 25 years.
The guy that really kicked things off was Chris Webber. He went into the booth with Chris Webber, who's here in the room with me now, and he struck up a conversation with him. He's warming Chris up, striking up a conversation. "Hey, Chris, do you write songs? Well, play me something you wrote." And he played something, and it was really good. Chris played it for me the other day, and it, really a nice folk piece. And Dylan said, "Hey, well, that's pretty good. Do you play me something else you wrote?" And he played him another one. Dylan was developing this great relationship, and he said, "Well, you really, really play well." And listen to this. And then he played this C minor chord that just sounded, you know, we heard it from outside, and Chris heard it there and later told me that, you know, it sounded a little odd to begin with. Once he learned it, Dylan sent him out of the booth and had him teach the song to the band. So Chris, who's on, I think at least probably four out of the five things recut, at least three, probably four out of the five things that are recut, Chris made major contributions to all those songs.
Mm-hmm.
And was really a spark in terms of the in terms of the guitar sound, that crispy, anonymous, bright Minneapolis sound that Paul Nelson refers to in the Rolling Stone reviews.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's Chris Webber.
Well, Chris Webber, Billy Peterson, Bill Berg, Kevin Odegaard, you know, rock history thanks you, even if Bob Dylan doesn't.
Thank you, Kevin. Thanks for being on Sound Opinions. We got to move on.
When we come back, we talk to Paul Metza and Rick Shefchik about their book on the re-recording process of the album. That's coming up on Sound Opinions. Someone's got
it in for me. Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
And we're back. We'd like to welcome the co-authors of a new book, Blood in the Tracks, the Minnesota musicians behind Dylan's masterpiece. Paul Metza, welcome to the show, Paul.
Thanks for having me.
And Rick Shefchik. Rick, how are you? Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You know, we have to ask any Dylanologist with a new book like this, my God, is there a popular musician about whom more has been written in the last century? Paul, why did you think it was worth you and Rick digging deep into what essentially was 2 days, two very historic days that helped produce a masterpiece, but what was the impetus for writing Blood in the Tracks?
Well, It actually started in 2001. I produced a show called The Million Dollar Bash at First Avenue and 7th Street Entry. We had 40 musicians from the Twin Cities. And I had actually gotten email requests to play for a bunch of Dylan fans in Turkey who had a horse farm and a sailing operation. And while I was considering that, I thought, well, it would Minneapolis would be really remiss, and Minnesota in general at large, to not do a tribute to Bob Dylan. So I got a hold of a guy named Nate Krantz at First Avenue, who just started working there. He was a young Dylan fan. And I called my friend Kevin Odegaard, who played guitar on Tangled Up in Blue, and I said, what are the chances of putting together the original guys who played on Blood on the Tracks? So he got on the phone, and a couple days later, he called me. He said, we've got five of the six guys that are ready to play. Now, what was interesting, they had not played together and in several instances seen each other since those two nights in December 1974. So they were kind of the highlight of the show. They came up and they played the entire record. Sold out show, huge success, 1,200 people. And that Odegaard kind of suggests that that was the origin for them to restart their campaign to get their credits on the record, because when the record came out, their names weren't listed on it. It just included the musicians from the New York sessions. So several years later, in 2018, when More Blood, More Tracks came out, the guys finally, what I like to say, got their ring. They finally got their names on the record. Yeah. So that was kind of the genesis of the restart for the campaign for that.
And you go into this some in the book. You know, partly Dylan was reconsidering those tracks at such a late stage. And, you know, at home on vacation in Minneapolis, his brother says, well, you know, do some recording. Tackle them again if you want. But the covers, the LP covers, were already at the printing plant, right?
Yeah. And then they were promised when the second pressing of the record came out that their names would appear on the record, but that never happened. So it was
But do you think that was intentional, or Dylan was just like, he was moving on already?
Well, I think everybody was that played on the session was paid standard scale, musician scale. And I think that was kind of part of it. Dylan moves quick. I also think Rick and I posited, and along with a couple of guys in the band, that because in the case of Tangled Up in Blue, Kevin Odegaard suggested to Bob that they should change the key from the key of G to the key of A. And then Greg Inhofer also made some suggestions on the songs he played on that possibly there might be some copyright issues. So I think the best way to for Columbia Records to deal with that is just to, hey, we paid them, let's move on.
Yeah. And that key change and Bill Berg's drumming are really what, by all accounts, by all the obsessive fans, that's what made the song.
Well, what's interesting is after the book came out, a fellow emailed me. Kevin Odegaard put out a book about the sessions in 2002 called Simple Twist of Fate. And they did a book release for that with all of the guys at a museum in Minneapolis in 2005. And a guy was there, told a great Bill Berg story, that Bill said there's no way he could have kept up with that 9-minute version of Lily Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts had it not been for the fact for his training playing all the polka gigs up on the Iron Range when he was growing up, because he was Berg was a hippie native as well.
The cap had been lifted and the gambling wheel shut down. Anyone with any sense had already left town. He was standing in the doorway looking like the Jack of Hearts.
You know, Paul, your book with Rick kind of fleshes out the story of these musicians. You know, they're good at what they do, but they're basically anonymous people. They're not famous musicians, but they're very good at what they do. They're working gigs. They had careers before and after Blood on the Tracks, but Blood on the Tracks certainly didn't broaden their, you know, profile, in large part because they weren't on the credits for the record. Nobody really knew that they had played on it until the box set came out for those sessions, 2018? Amazing that it wasn't corrected until that point.
Yes, one of our big points that we wanted to make in the book, when over the years, the musicians from Minneapolis got slagged off as just garage band musicians, anonymous, faceless, people that didn't add anything to the record. Well, it wouldn't have sold 2.5 million copies had these Minneapolis sessions not been included on the original Blood on the Tracks. And I had moved to Minneapolis in 1978. I was very familiar with Bill Berg and Billy Peterson. They were the house rhythm section at Sound 80 Studios. They played on most of Leo Kottke's early records, and I was a huge Leo Kottke fan. So one of the points in the book was these guys were anything but garage band musicians. These guys were some of the best musicians in Minneapolis. And you know, Jim, you've been in Minneapolis. If you're as good as in Minneapolis, you're as good as anywhere in the country. So that was the point, not only to get these guys' names in the book, but to say what great musicians they were and what they added to the record, which is, you know, proof is in the pudding.
You know, Rick, I'm glad Paul just mentioned that there's a Minneapolis vibe, a Minneapolis personality. And I think one of the things you both do well in the book is to underscore, you know, Dylan came from this place. He related to these guys. And, you know, that and the fact that his brother brought these guys in. And, you know, talk about the Minneapolis of it all.
Well, that is the other real reason that Paul and I wrote the book. One is to give props to these Minneapolis musicians who a lot of people seem to think really weren't qualified to re-record half the album. But the other was to explain why it worked. And clearly it did work. And Paul and I have always thought, because Paul knows these musicians so well, and you know, I've lived most, if not all, of my life in Minnesota, we've always thought that the reason Blood on the Tracks worked so well with the Minneapolis musicians was the shared DNA that Dylan has with them. They all grew up in the same general musical milieu, although Dylan was a little bit ahead of them in terms of, you know, just his age, and, you know, came up playing mostly folk music. But even before that, he was a rock and roller in Hibbing High School. Mm-hmm. So all of these guys really did have an understanding of what the Minneapolis music scene was, how good it was, and were convinced that Dylan felt much more comfortable playing with these guys, even though he didn't know them. He was introduced to every one of them that night by his brother. But we just think there was a shared vibe there that made that session so much more successful than the New York sessions.
Yeah, your book really details how Dylan had a comfort level with these guys. He was talking to them just like they were peers. You know, it wasn't like I'm dictating to you. I mean, the big revelation for me was, well, he showed him the chords. You know, he showed him, okay, this is how we play the song. He didn't do that all the time with musicians that he worked with.
Well, clearly in New York, he didn't do that at all. Mm-hmm. And that was probably the basis of the failure of those sessions. And when I say failure, I mean relative to the Minneapolis sessions, because a lot of good music came out of New York. But as we pointed out, and has been mentioned before, the New York musicians felt very frustrated that he really wasn't helping them learn the songs.
And Dylan himself wasn't happy. He knew there was something a little off.
I think he walked out of the studio feeling fairly satisfied. But as Phil Ramone mentioned later on, the longer a record goes from the time it was recorded to the time it's released, the more the artist has time to start having second thoughts. And since it became a better record anyway, it's fairly clear that those second thoughts that Dylan had probably were starting to bubble up fairly soon.
Hmm. 5 songs in 2 days. That's an amazingly productive session. All keepers. Basically half the album's recorded in 2 days with those Minneapolis guys. They get paid union scale. That's it. You know, your book makes this clear, and it seems like there was a paperwork snafu. Here's where David Zimmerman dropped the ball, right? Somehow there wasn't any paperwork, contracts signed to get these guys paid properly, so they never saw any royalties from the recording, which they should have by rights, right?
Yeah, and Greg Inhofer has suggested, he doesn't know this for a fact, but he thinks that the reason that their names never showed up on the album was that once the first run was done, Columbia thought, we didn't get any signatures from these guys. We didn't get any releases. Who knows what they might claim for their work on that session. So if we keep their names off of the subsequent jackets, then maybe they'll never be in a position to claim any more money.
Unbelievable.
But the funny thing to me was when they had these reunions years later, and Eric Weissberg showed up for one of them, and Inhofer said, "Say, Eric, did you get a gold record for Tangled Up in Blue? And he said, yeah, it's been on my wall for a long time. Well, Eric Weisberg doesn't play a note on Tangled Up in Blue. And Greg Inhofer was on five of the songs and got nothing.
Right. There is that, you know, say the downside of what they called Minnesota nice when I lived there is, you know, people in Minnesota are self-effacing and salt of the earth and not egotistical. Can't say that about New York, right? But the downside is sometimes you get stepped on, and these guys were well and truly stepped on. You know, people always think, Greg, that this stuff started with the hip-hop and sampling controversies. Yeah, right. It's like, you know, people have been getting screwed. And, you know, and was long before Robert Johnson got screwed.
Right.
Our six Minneapolis musicians got screwed.
Say for me that I'm all right, though things get kind of slow. She might think that I've forgotten her. Don't tell her it isn't so.
You guys do a great job of telling the stories about these guys as working musicians before and after the sessions. And they continued to work afterward. They didn't have any greater fame for it. Kevin Odegaard talks about the fact that it was the greatest 6 minutes of his life, which is both a great thing to see and kind of sad. You know, it's kind of like, that was it. That was the golden moment. And I had it, and it's gone, and, you know, I'll never have a moment to equal that. How did the guys hold up in general? Was there, you guys talked to them, you knew them. Did the bitterness ever settle in, you know, where they just felt screwed royally, or did they just sort of ride it out without any recriminations?
Not at all. I got to be friends with with all of them, and played with several of them over the years. All of them look back on it very positively. Inhofer went through kind of its moments of doubt with it, but even now, I mean, if you would talk to any of them, it was, you know, one of the greatest sessions of their life. I mean, in Minnesota, it's like we had, you know, two World Series, and in terms of Minnesota moments, it's up there with those, as well as, you know, anything else great that happened in Minnesota. But what was interesting, what I found out when I was talking earlier about when Odegaard's Simple Twist of Fate came out, they did the show at the Mill City Museum, Bill Berg said, and we weren't aware of this or we would have put it in the book, that he was offered the chance to go on the road with Dylan after those sessions, and he turned it down. He ended up going to California and working with Walt Disney as an animator. But he just got out of the biz for a while. Although he's playing now, he recently recorded with Judy Collins and all of the other musicians, with the exception of Peter Ostrouchko and Chris Weber, who unfortunately both passed away before Rick got involved with the book, are all still working musicians. Odegaard plays every now and then. He's put out a record or two of original music, but they're all pretty satisfied with being a part of that momentous record.
I would have to say, honestly, that there's a spectrum of regret among the six musicians. If you look at Bill Berg, for instance, who went on to be a really successful animator at Disney, I doubt that he ever looked back with any sense of regret whatsoever. His life went in a different direction, which satisfied him enormously.
Hey, he worked on the Little Mermaid and the Lion King.
Beauty and the Beast. Yeah. An incredible run for him. But you look at Peter Ostrouchko, and he could hardly have become more successful than he was as a mandolinist in America. Mm-hmm. I mean, he worked with everybody he wanted to. Kevin is sort of in the middle, because I think he did realize, as he said, after playing on Tangled Up in Blue, he kind of knew that was it. That was the peak. And he went on to do interesting things as well, but I'm pretty sure he knew that he wasn't going to do anything much more than that. I think Chris Weber probably had as many regrets as anyone, because after the Podium Guitar Store went out of business, that pretty much took him out of music. And that was really his first love. And I think there was some thought that had their name been on the album, possibly Chris's music career might have lasted a little bit longer. And we know that Kevin Odegaard has mentioned frequently that even though he's not bitter, he does face the reality that things could have gone a lot better for the musicians had they gotten the credit.
Mm-hmm. You know, it really is a story of regular working musicians. a brush with fame there, but for the grace of God, they might have had more. But, you know, I was thinking as I was reading it of another a couple of legendary Minnesota musicians, Ray and Glover. Right. You know, Dylan was so influenced by that blues duo early on as a youngster, you know, and the number of times I saw Ray and Glover playing, you know, on a Monday night, you know, and half the bar, more than half, is paying no attention. Right. But they were making money playing music. And sometimes that's all you get.
Yeah. And Dave Ray became a very good friend of mine. And I still see Kerner Jim, if you ever get back to the West Bank, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you can go to Palmer's and bump into John doing the New York Times crossword puzzle. But Dylan says, and John's not totally on board with it. He said, Bob's memory might be a little skewed here, but Dylan did some of his first gigs in Minneapolis with John Kerner. Credits John with being such a huge influence on himself. So Kerner looms large in the history of music, but certainly a big influence on Bob Dylan.
Absolutely. Guys, great story. I'm glad you finally gave these worthy musicians the light of day, you know, in terms of recognition, right? The book is called Blood in the Tracks. Highly recommend it. It's about the Blood on the Tracks sessions. We've been talking to Paul Metza and Rick Shefchik. We appreciate you guys being on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Really enjoyed it. Thank you, guys.
That wraps up our classic album dissection of Blood on the Tracks. Now, we want to hear from you. Where does this album rank for you in the pantheon of Dylan's catalog? Leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org. Mr. Cott, what is on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we have a bounty of riches because there are so many great TV theme songs out there that we just want to play a few of our favorites. And do not forget to check out our bonus podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our Columbia College intern is Max Hatlam, and our social media consultant is Katie Cott.